If you have your Bibles with you today, I invite you to turn to Habakkuk chapter 2. Habakkuk chapter 2 as we read verses 15 through 17 this morning. This is the word of the Lord. Woe to you who make your neighbors drink, who mix in your venom even to make them drunk, so as to look on their nakedness. You will be filled with disgrace rather than honor. Now you yourself drink and expose your own nakedness. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter disgrace will come upon your glory. For the violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and the devastation of its beasts by which you terrified them, because of human bloodshed and violence done to the land, to the town, and all its inhabitants. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Senseless acts of violence, terrorism, murder, drug and alcohol abuse, sexual abuse, environmental disasters, systemic injustice in which some are punished beyond the extent of their crimes and others get off unpunished. Such things plague our society today. In fact, this week I was watching with a keen eye just the scrolling of the headlines. And almost every story to come across the screen was related to one or the other of those issues. And yet, constantly we hear people say that the Bible is an antiquated book that has no relevance to our contemporary world. Friends, in three verses that we just read, we see all of those matters addressed clearly. Habakkuk lived 2,600 years ago, approximately. And yet in his day, society was plagued by the very same concerns that affect us today. This very week, in our own state, we've seen images in the news that take us back decades to a day and time that we all hoped that we'd move beyond. But these societal concerns that we've listed, and more that we could add to the list, are not the root of the problem. They are symptoms of an underlying cause, and that underlying cause is human sinfulness. Because the human heart and mind are warped by sin, we see the same manifestations of it over and over again throughout history. We cannot evolve beyond it. We cannot educate ourselves out of it. Habakkuk's day and age was much like our own. The primary concerns of the righteous Israelites involved the moral degradation of their homeland and global unrest sparked by militant terror on the part of the Babylonians who had branched out from modern-day Iraq to conquer by force and destruction. And many of them wondered why God didn't stop all this. Surprisingly, God had declared that he was in fact using all this to accomplish his purpose. You see, the Jewish people had violated their covenant with God, and they earned for themselves divine chastening and judgment, and Babylon was the tool that God would use to deliver that judgment upon them. But the Babylonians do not get a pass. They're not exempt from God's moral standards. They didn't see themselves as divine agents of his sovereign will, but instead they saw themselves as emissaries of their pagan deities and as people on a mission to establish a name for themselves in the world in the name of their gods. And so in the exercise of their terror, they exceeded what was appropriate. They exceeded what was fitting. And the punishment that they inflicted on the nations exceeded the crimes for which God was using them to bring about judgment. And now the crimes of the Babylonians had to be punished in turn. Now, the passage that we've read today is part and parcel of a larger section dealing with the impending doom of Babylon. Though they had conquered many lands and enslaved many peoples, the day was soon to come, within a century, in which all the survivors of those peoples would see Babylon fall and would taunt and mock them in their demise. So we have five pronouncements of woe, or taunt songs, as they're called here, from verses 6 through 20. We've considered three of them in the weeks past. This is the fourth today. And in this one, we're dealing with the issue of crime and punishment. Namely, the crimes committed by the Babylonians and the punishment that would soon come upon them. But friends, you must know, this is not merely a lesson in ancient Mesopotamian history. As we have said, the issues that were plaguing the world in that day are no different than the issues that are occupying the news hour in our day. The crimes committed by the Babylonians here in our text are parallel to many things that we see going on around us, and therefore, the punishment that is meted out in the justice of God for those crimes must be relevant to us as well. So the first thing we notice in these three verses is that the crimes of sinful men are many. The crimes of sinful men are many, and we see that in verses 15 and 17. Every generation, I suppose, has had a person or entity that it considered to be the epitome of evil in the world. Most recently, perhaps, we might say it was Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda or ISIS or Boko Haram. A generation ago, it would have been Adolf Hitler. Excuse me, I'm about to sneeze. Oh, sometimes just saying it makes it better. Like confession, it's good for your soul. A generation ago, we spoke of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Third Reich as the epitome of evil. In Habakkuk's day, there would have been few, if any, who would have contested the moniker rightly belonging to Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire. It's an interesting convergence of the accounts that we have in the Bible and in the secular historians and even in the ascriptions of the Babylonians themselves, that there's this great agreement about the atrocities that were committed in the expansion of Nebuchadnezzar's empire. Prior to his enthronement, he'd been the leading general of his father's army, and his father, Nabopolassar, had started this reign and this extension of the imperial domain, and Nebuchadnezzar just followed suit militantly, violently, terroristically. By the time Habakkuk's book was written, Nebuchadnezzar's name was synonymous with terror and violence in the world. Verse 15 begins to list the charges against him and against his regime. And the first charge concerns the defiling of the human body. We see it in drunkenness. We see it in debauchery. Verse 15 says, "Woe to you who make your neighbors drink, who mix in your venom even to make them drunk." The propensity for the abuse of alcohol in ancient Babylon is well documented. But notice a familiar theme here, that they were not content to just intoxicate themselves. No, they forced their drink on others in order to intoxicate them as well. You know, the old saying is misery loves company. And nowhere is that more evident to us than in the misery of sinful behavior. As Robertson writes, part of the depravity inherent in sin is its insistence on involving others in its debauchery. The Babylonian king is not satisfied with making himself drunk. He can rest contentedly only when he has forced his degradation on others. He delights with a twisted glee to see others indulging in the same sins. And you know this is true. You see it around you. You see it happening. People engaging in behavior that displeases the Lord, and they're quick to invite others to come along and join them in it. Well, their goal in all this, spelled out, why did the Babylonians want to get their neighbors drunk? Verse 15 tells us, so as to look on their nakedness. It's a bit of a euphemistic expression here, a softening down of words that today we might better call rape. Sexual assault. What the Babylonians and presumably even their king had done to others was no different than what we heard in the news recently about the Stanford incident of Brock Turner who abused and raped this helpless woman behind a dumpster. And that's but one incident. Ask any college student. And they will tell you that it happens to someone they know on a fairly regular basis. Drunkenness and sexual sin, sexual perversion, sexual violence, sexual victimization go together oh so often. That's not new. The only thing that's new about it, in fact, is the reality that we've become numb to the horror and shame of it. Some have said that we live in a rape culture. Well, maybe that's accurate. I would also say it's an intoxicated culture. Drugs and alcohol are as much a part of everyday life for so many as are the various sexual perversions that are so prevalent. So we've been, as a society, pornographied. And our culture is too intoxicated, too inebriated to notice or even care. It's been well said by some that we're like the frog in a kettle who doesn't know that it's being boiled alive. Because we're immersed in this kind of thing in our media and in our even our news stories, it's like they should put a warning label on the news. Don't watch this with your children because it's rated R. Yeah, and we're like a frog in the kettle. We don't realize that we're being boiled alive in the things that we're exposed to. Now, perhaps you might say, we shouldn't talk about these kinds of things in church. Well, as I hope you've noticed, the Bible isn't silent about these things. And one of the things that we always need to do is we need to speak where the Bible speaks and we need to shut up where the Bible shuts up, right? Too many times we're shutting up about things that the Bible is speaking about, and that's how we get where we are in a culture. So the Bible isn't silent about these things, so we shouldn't be silent about these things. But you say, well, nobody wants to hear about these things. I disagree, because in fact, it seems like everybody wants to hear about these things. That's why it fills all the movies. That's why it fills all the television shows. That's why it fills all the literature, all the music, and even the newscasts of our day. We can't be silent about it. We live in a hyper-sexualized society that has intoxicated itself into thinking that these kinds of things are normal, acceptable, and permissible. How can that kind of society not fall under the hammer of God's judgment? Look down through history every single time a society goes down these roads, it is short-lived. As if that wasn't enough, this crime of defiling the human body by drunkenness and debauchery, we see the list of crimes doesn't end. It moves on to the destruction of the natural world. Verse 17 speaks of what else drunken Babylon had done to exploit all nature. We read violence that was done to Lebanon and the devastation of its beasts. Not only do drunkenness and sexual deviance go hand in hand, but violence usually comes along for the party as well. And in Babylon's case, this violence was widespread and all-encompassing. The violence done to Lebanon. It speaks of an environmental disaster. Lebanon was known for one thing primarily in that day and time, and that was its magnificent cedar groves. The cedars of Lebanon were as proverbial as the sequoias of California. For thousands of years prior to Habakkuk's time, Lebanon's cedars had been utilized in the building of temples and the buildings of ships around the world. Just before the rise of Babylon, Sennacherib of Assyria boasted. Isaiah records it in chapter 37. I came up to the heights of the mountains, to the remotest parts of Lebanon, and I cut down its tall cedars and its choice cypresses. Nebuchadnezzar just followed suit. He stripped the forests of Lebanon bare to provide lumber for all that he was building for his namesake across his empire. Remember in verse 11, it was said that the rafters of the framework of Babylon's buildings would cry out against them. Those rafters were made from Lebanon cedar. In the malicious deforestation of Lebanon, the Babylonians also brought calamity upon the wildlife native to the area. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, verse 17, and the devastation of its beasts by which you terrified them. Some of the many animals that lived in those cedar forests lost their habitat. Many more undoubtedly were killed senselessly for sport, amusement, or entertainment. Now, in our day, there's this notion in the minds of some people that if you talk about conservation of the environment and animal life, then you must be some kind of tree-hugging liberal. I think most of you know me well enough to know that I'm not a tree-hugging liberal. All right? But we do need to take these issues seriously if we take the Bible seriously. I think for too long there's been this sort of caricature that if you're a conservative person, that means that you drive down the highway exceeding the speed limit, throwing styrofoam containers out your window onto the side of the road and boycotting the recycling truck when it comes down the street once a week. You know? No. We take environmental and natural issues seriously because the Bible takes those issues seriously. God commanded humanity to exercise dominion, which is a different thing from domination, over all that God had created. As one scholar put it, it's one thing to rule over creation, respecting it as God's creation, entrusted to us for the moment. It's quite another thing to exploit it unmercifully, as though it belonged to us absolutely, as though we were not accountable for it to its creator. Oh, I understand. Our theology is solid. We do believe that the world is passing away and will be created by God when the new heaven and the new earth are established at the end of all things, just like our bodies will be resurrected to immortality. But until then, we take care of our bodies and we take care of our world as stewards of the God we serve, who made us and the world in which we live to bring glory to Himself. So, the crime is listed here about the destruction of the natural world. And then finally, we see the crime of the devaluing of human life. Bloodshed and violence done in the land, the town, and to all of its inhabitants. Ruthlessly, mercilessly, the Babylonians tortured and slaughtered multitudes carrying out the spread of its empire. Every one of those victims who was tortured, oppressed, afflicted, and murdered was made in the image of God. And God never turns a blind eye toward the taking of innocent lives. Violence in our day has become a form of entertainment. And that's resulted in a devaluing of human life from conception to natural death, from the womb to the tomb. Generations now have been desensitized to bloodshed and violence. Things that would have repulsed us decades ago now entertain us, resulting in the kinds of things that we see taking place, like on the news from Charlotte this very week, and around the country and around the world in these days. Friends, there is a God who takes note of all these things. Every senseless death, every senseless act of violence is the end of a life that was created to display God's image on the earth. And God will issue the final verdict in perfect justice at His appointed time. He does not let these things go unnoticed in heaven. And so that leads us from the discussion of the crimes committed by sinful men, which are many, to the discussion of the punishment of a holy God, which is justified. Verse 16 tells us what is coming for Babylon. Injustice is what underlies much of the unrest that surrounds us today. Punishments do not fit the crimes that are committed so often. Imperfect cops make imperfect decisions. Imperfect observers jump to imperfect conclusions. Imperfect judges and juries make imperfect judgments. And sometimes the innocent are condemned, or worse, sometimes the guilty go free. We don't turn a blind eye to injustice. We can't hold our tongues in the face of injustice. But we also have to view injustice through the lens of eternity. And in that perspective, we see that injustice, as horrible as it is temporary. Maybe you remember the name Christopher Darden. He was one of the prosecutors in the O.J. Simpson murder trial. And afterward, Christopher Darden looked back on the incident of the trial, and he said this. He said, "I never got to cross-examine O.J. Simpson, but if I had, I wanted to tell him that there was another court that would hear his case one day with a judge who would try racist cops and murderers. A court where everyone will have to account for his actions alone, without lawyers or jurors. A court where there will be no need for DNA or gloves, and the only witnesses will be the eyewitnesses. the God of perfect justice, will undo all injustice and see to it that every person's punishment fits his or her crimes with precision when the final court comes to session. And verse 16 describes what that will look like for Babylon. All that was done during the tyrannical reign of Babylon's rulers was done to exalt themselves and bring honor to themselves. But the Lord says that a day is coming when they would be filled with disgrace rather than honor. The world would see all that was done in the building of their empire, and there would be no room for honor on that day when it was all revealed. It would only be disgrace and shame. Babylon will receive in itself what it had inflicted upon others. Verse 16 gives us this sarcastic command. Now, you yourself drink and expose your own nakedness. You've been making others drunk to expose their nakedness. Now it's your turn to drink and expose your own. Friends, I studied the Hebrew language for over 2 years in seminary, and I can tell you that the original language here is very graphic and indelicate. Your English translators have sensitized the text here for decorum. As most of you know, the Hebrew people practice circumcision as an outward sign of their membership in the covenant community of God's people. The idea that's expressed here in the original language is that the drunken Babylonian will be left exposed, passed out and naked. And what is seen in his nakedness will reveal that he has no relationship in the covenant of God. Okay? Is that clear enough? The Lord used them to administer his cup of judgment on Judah for its sins, but that didn't bind Babylon into a relationship of faith and righteousness with God. And therefore, now the cup has come around full circle to be drank to the dregs by these ruthless Babylonians. The cup in the Lord's right hand, a symbol of power. You will powerfully be given this cup in the Lord's right hand, this cup of judgment. And when this cup comes and Babylon's nakedness is exposed, their only covering will be, the New American Standard translates it, utter disgrace. Again, protecting somewhat our sensitivities. To translate this literally, well, the King James comes the closest to it. If you have a King James version with you, look in verse 16, and it says that that last line, you'll be covered with, or will come upon you, this what? Shameful spewing. Shameful spewing. Now, in a context of drunkenness, it's not hard to understand what the reference is to. It's vomit. Theo Leitch put it this way: dead drunk, the proud Chaldean shall lie naked on the floor in his own vomit, an object of horror and ridicule for all the world. Verse 14 promised us that in the final day the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord as water covers the sea. But what about the glory of Babylon and all who are like her? It will be covered in the utter disgrace of shameful spewing. Well, there's good news in these words for human beings who've been oppressed and afflicted by injustice, who've been exploited, who've been taken advantage of, who've been wrongfully victimized. Perfect justice is coming, and all those who have transgressed God's standard of righteousness will be made to drink from the cup that he holds in his right hand. Now, that's good news, but that is also very bad news. Because every single one of us has transgressed that very same standard of God's righteousness in our own sins against each other and against this holy God. And so before we celebrate too greatly this day of judgment that's coming on all those wrongdoers, we have to see ourselves in the crowd of wrongdoers, that it's coming for each and every one of us. And it's only when we grasp the depth of that bad news that we can fully appreciate the glory of the good news that is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Because you see, friends, he came into the world to drink this cup on our behalf. On the night before he died on the cross, he's in the Garden of Gethsemane praying, "My Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. What cup is he talking about? He's talking about this cup. The cup that is the wrath of God's judgment. Jesus has not done anything to earn his Father's wrath. Why would he have to drink that cup? Because he is drinking it for me and for you and for all who trust in his name. Father, he says, let this cup pass from me if it's possible, yet not as I will, but as you will. He goes on to say, my Father, if this cup cannot pass away unless I drink it, your will be done. That cup that Jesus is talking about contains the sins of the whole world and God's righteous judgment against all of that sin. And the only way to rescue us from the wrath and condemnation that is due to us was for him to drink the cup in our place, and he drank it to the dregs. He shed his blood for the blood that we have shed in our rebellion against God. He bore the penalty that we deserve. He drank the cup that was intended for us so that he could offer us a different cup instead. He offers us a cup of his own blood and invites us to drink it and enter into a new covenant relationship with God. He says, drink from it, all of you. For this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. Jesus takes the punishment for our crimes, our violence, our hatred, our lust, our abuse, our arrogance, our greed, of which we are all guilty, so that we might be pardoned before the judgment bar of God. And so it is, my friends, as if two cups are put on the table before you, the cup of judgment and the cup of salvation. And the Lord Jesus stands at that table and says, I will drink the cup of judgment for you and fill the cup of salvation with my blood for you to drink and be forgiven. The psalmist said, what shall I render to the Lord for all of his benefits toward me? I shall lift the cup of salvation and call upon the name of the Lord. And friends, the Bible promises us that whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. So the question is, which cup will you choose? The one that you deserve, or the one that Jesus offers you by his grace, having drank the one that you deserve in your place? Let's pray.